Welcome to today's weather talk. With summer underway here in the States, many people are enjoying the long hours of daylight by getting together with friends to play sports. And with the delayed Summer Olympics from 2020, starting this Friday, July 23rd, 2021, I thought I'd turn the podcast focus onto sports and weather. So, do they play well together, or are they more like cats and dogs? I want to dedicate this to all my students who tell me constantly, quote, weather has nothing to do with my life, end quote, and to two very special friends of mine who are huge sports fans. All right, let the games begin. So first we're going to start with a general top view of the elements and their effects on sporting events. Starting with temperature, excessive heat. We know that summer is hot, but why exactly is it so hot? Well, you've probably heard on the news the feels like or real feel temperature. This is not the actual air temperature, but instead a measurement that takes into account the relative humidity to indicate what's called the heat stress index. So, for example, an air temperature of 96 Fahrenheit with 50% relative humidity feels like 108 degrees Fahrenheit to your human body, or even worse, 88 degrees Fahrenheit with 100% relative humidity can feel like it's really 121 degrees. Wow, that's hot. So for athletes, sometimes training in a new environment for heat acclimatization, especially in college sports regulated by the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, that's mandatory. The idea is to reduce the risk of heat stroke and hopefully improve performance. Another surprising fact is that temperatures affect the density of air. So in higher temperatures, the air is thinner, leading to changes in drag on game balls, and in other sports like cycling, less drag and faster cycling times. And now freezing cold. Just as in our excessive heat conditions, very cold is also unfriendly to the human body, let alone the human body trying to compete in a sport. Your muscles get tighter, it's harder to breathe, frostbite and hypothermia are all potential risks. Something that might surprise you is that athletes in the cold are actually at greater risk for dehydration since the air is drier in colder weather. That's why you might feel lung burn, as I call it, on those extra cold, dry days. Next up, precipitation. You might be aware that some sports are canceled because of precipitation. Others can be canceled when the ground is merely damp due to risk for injury. The following sports are prone to these types of cancellations. We have auto racing like NASCAR or IndyCar, baseball, cricket, golf, and tennis. If there's an excessive amount of rain, sometimes the ground isn't able to absorb it because it's already saturated. This is called waterlogging, and cancellations can also occur due to waterlogging. And of course, winter sports need a sufficient amount of the fluffy white stuff for the sport to take place to begin with. So if there isn't enough, they can be canceled, or even if there's too much snow, they can be canceled. These are sports like skiing, sledding, or snowboarding. The next weather element affecting sporting events is wind. A good gust of wind could be the difference between making that field goal and a miss. The obvious outdoor sports affected by this would be American football, baseball or softball, soccer, tennis, badminton, and golf. When playing a sport outside with a game ball, there are a few forces at work. One is gravity, pulling the ball down. Another is lift, hence the aerodynamic shape of certain sport game balls, specifically an example being a football. And finally, friction in the form of air resistance or drag. The lift is provided by the player throwing the ball, whether that's the quarterback or a pitcher. It's also helpful for players to practice in all types of wind situations to hone their ability to compensate for additional drag or additional lift. The further the ball is thrown in the game, the more likely it will be affected by this weather element. However, it's not all bad because wind is also crucial to certain competitive sports, most notably being boat racing, towed water sports like water skiing, and board sports like surfing. That's right, no wind, no surfing. How sad would that be? Now, we mentioned thinner air because of temperature earlier, but what about thinner air because of, well, pressure or increasing altitude? The vertical structure of our atmosphere is that the air pressure decreases with height. Okay, so what does this have to do with competitive sports, Professor? Well, let's say, for example, my team, the Nittany Lions from Penn State, are playing in Miami. They might struggle with the heat in Miami because it's not like their home turf in Penn State, right? Now, if they played a team in Denver, Colorado, they might also struggle. Why? Because again, the Colorado team lives, trains, and plays regularly at 5,280 feet above sea level, or 1 mile above sea level, whereas State College PA sits at an altitude of a mere 1,154 feet. Now, that difference may not seem like much, but consider if you were to climb to the top of Mount Everest, you'd be above almost 70% of the atmosphere because the atmosphere is thickest if you go towards the bottom near the surface. Okay, so how do our athletes handle these changes in altitude? Well, there's something called altitude training. Major research into altitude training started after the 1968 Olympics. Since they were held at 7,349 feet above sea level in Mexico City, Mexico, several sprinting event records were broken, but the endurance type events suffered at this higher elevation. These are perfect examples of why altitude training is now so popular. This type of training is regularly practiced by some endurance athletes where they relocate to a higher altitude and train there for several weeks at a time. Usually these still aren't considered high altitudes per se, more like an intermediate level altitude, but it gives the same effects. Other techniques include using an altitude simulation tent or room, and or using a mask-based hypoxicator system, which lowers the oxygen but keeps the pressure the same. A more scary technique, hypoventilation training. Yes, this is a thing. It reduces the breathing frequency and is supposed to decrease the blood and muscle oxygenation. The idea behind all these procedures and training is to acclimate the body to the relative lack of oxygen in the new higher altitude environment. Some athletes even believe that living high and training low can increase their performance, or another regime is the live high, train high, where the athlete lives and trains at a higher altitude. But research has mixed results from all these regimes. Scientists and athletes continue to research both on the hypoxia side, that's little to no oxygen, to the other end of the scale with a oxygen enrichment to determine its effects on training and performance. So now for a personal example, I have experienced this to some degree. I joined my sister on her orientation camping trip for college at Black Elk Peak, South Dakota, which is the highest peak in the state, formerly known as Harney Peak. Now we were both totally jet lagged, fresh off the plane, and maybe suffering from a minor sinus infection when we went on this excursion, which was required for incoming freshmen. Needless to say, after spending a night in the tent, getting up early the next day to hike this Black Elk Peak, which is 7,242 feet above sea level, we had just come from the eastern shore of Maryland, where we lived, and the elevation was a mere 42 feet above sea level. So as we begin the hike, the sign at the beginning of the trail informs us, one, that the difficulty level is high. Of course it is, right? And two, the trail is 6 miles long, up, down, sideways. And three, it takes 4 to 5 hours. I want to stress hours. I don't think any of the other students who were native South Dakotans read the sign because they just took off like that sign didn't exist. And it was just like a stroll on the beach. Needless to say, yours truly and her sister were on the struggle bus hardcore all the way up and back. You really don't know the effects of altitude on your body until you've had this kind of experience for yourself. And by the way, in extreme conditions like Mount Everest, the thin, high altitude air can kill you if you don't bring proper equipment. And finally, of note, visibility can affect sporting competitions. When you can't see the other players, let alone the ball, you've got problems. Most notably here, cricket matches will actually be canceled in heavy fog conditions. The umpire is responsible for calling, quote, poor lighting conditions, and it can be pretty controversial. Okay, I'm going to move into the big three sports, and I'm going to discuss in order popularity in the United States. According to sportsshow.net, most popular in the United States is American football, then baseball, then basketball and ice hockey, which we'll skip because they're mainly played indoors. Next is soccer, also known as football in the rest of the world, then tennis, golf, and motorsports. So first we're going to start with American football, which I will refer to as just football from here forward. Now, just in case you think that weather elements don't play a contributing factor in football games, check this out. Dome stadium games played score on average about 4 points more per game than outdoor games, especially in November and December. Warm weather games also tend to have more scored points than cold weather games, according to safestbettingsites.com. Let's see how each element affects this game. So we start with excessive heat. I personally remember watching the college football Orange Bowl game back in January of 2006. That game was crazy. It went into triple overtime. I remember thinking I'd run out of VHS tape. Yes, it was that long ago. Anyway, what does this have to do with excessive heat, you ask? Well, my team, the Penn State Nittany Lions, were not used to playing in Miami, Florida, a location known for its heat and humidity. So the Florida State team clearly had at least one advantage since they were based in Tallahassee, Florida. Kickoff was at 8 p.m. local. As the game wore on, Penn State players started dropping like flies from exhaustion, muscle cramps, and dehydration. The winning field goal was kicked at 1 a.m. So yeah, that was a very late night. This game personally made me wonder if more is needed to be done to protect players from the elements. But in all seriousness, heat kills. Because from 1995 to 2012, the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Industry Research found that 52 football players died from exertional heat stroke, or EHS. That's terrible and totally preventable. Scientists are still researching safer methods, and the Wet Bulb Globe Temperature Index, or WBGT, you'll hear this a lot in this podcast, is used in many sports to determine safety of play. Perhaps it can and should be incorporated here. By the way, Penn State won that game 26-23, I'm just saying. And the hottest NFL game recorded was a scorching 102 Fahrenheit on the AstroTurf at Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe, Arizona back in 2003, where the Arizona Cardinals beat the Green Bay Packers 20-13, according to sportscasting.com. Switching to cold now, did you know that cold affects the football itself? That's right. Air pressure decreases inside the football are similar to your car tires. Remember having to fill them up after the first cold snap every year? Same thing applies here. That pressure drop also makes it harder to make kicks and punts. In extreme pressure drops, it can even require using more force than usual to strike the ball. And apparently this makes the football a bit crinkly because it doesn't respond as well in cold weather compared to warmer weather. Also, player grip strengths have been shown to decrease rapidly in freezing temperatures. A 2016 study found that if temperature is below 20 degrees Fahrenheit, turnovers will increase by 42%. And if it's below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, it jumps up to 52%. Yikes. As I said before, that lung burn that gets to us mere mortals, yeah, it affects our favorite sports players as well. This makes players' muscles more stiff, and it might, in some cases, lead to injury. In addition to all of that, colder weather makes the players' bodies use up energy 5 times faster. They lose stamina, and their reaction times can drop by nearly half. It gets colder and colder, and it gets harder and harder to gain yardage. Warmer weather games have 5% more yardage than cold weather games, and all of the above, not surprisingly, leads to lower points scored in colder weather games compared to warmer weather games, sometimes a drop of almost 11%, and those stats came from the USA Today. Some secret ways the players stay warm: using heat packs and muffs, usually inside the sleeves, especially for the quarterback. Heated insoles are popular, which also helps prevent injury. Spring antiperspirants inside shoes before games can reduce chill from evaporating sweat. Heated benches are pretty common as well as heaters and blowers, but people can get injured by these and or there's an increased risk of fire, which is bad. And the age-old favorite, dress in layers. Why? Because it works. Essentially, use your own body to rewarm yourself. And according to theactivetimes.com, the coldest ever NFL game was played January 10th, 1982, when the San Diego Chargers played the Cincinnati Bengals at Cincinnati Riverfront Stadium, where it was -9 Fahrenheit. That's the real temperature, okay? Nicknamed the Freezer Bowl. I love that. The 35 mile per hour winds made the wind chill a very cold -38 degrees Fahrenheit. OMG. Guess who won? That's right. Hometown advantage played off for the Bengals over the Chargers 27-7. Another honorable mention, the Ice Bowl, played December 31st, 1967. This NFL championship game between the Green Bay Packers and the Dallas Cowboys sported a temperature of 13 degrees below zero. Whew. And what effect does precipitation have on football? Rain isn't just annoying when it comes to American football, it can be downright dangerous. It's been proven that a wet field can increase the risk of injury for the players. The offensive team is actually in the better position since they know the play. However, the defense is at a loss in wet conditions since reacting to the play can cause slipping and hence injury. A wet football is harder to throw and catch, which would be basics of the game, and toweling the football off can only do so much in a heavy downpour. Snow seems to have a deeper impact on field goals than rain does on the whole. In December 1979, the game between the Buccaneers and the Kansas City Chiefs will be dubbed the quote monsoon game after the heavens seemed to open up upon the stadium, causing waterfalls on the stadium steps, 7 fumbles and 5 turnovers. And let's not forget snow here. In 1982, December, Foxborough, Massachusetts, the infamous snowplow game was played between the Patriots and the Dolphins. This game win was controversial because a snowplow, really a John Deere tractor, was brought in to clear a spot for the special teams kicker, which ended up being the winning play. Sounds kind of shady, doesn't it? In American football, it's not just the speed of the football that's important, but the direction is also crucial. The wind is the single most impacting weather element on American football games. High winds have been known to change the direction of the football mid-air, leading to failed plays and frustrated players and fans alike. As reported by a Buffalo, New York local news column, as wind speed increases, there is a direct correlation to decreasing passing statistics like passing yards, yards per attempt, passer rating, and completion percentage, meaning that the teams will generally run the football instead of trying to pass as a response to the adverse wind conditions. Don't think that the quarterback is the only player affected either. The place kicker may also struggle with field goal attempts in higher wind conditions. The windiest game in the NFL was 40 miles per hour in Cleveland in a game between the St. Louis Rams and the Cleveland Browns back in 2011. The score was 13-12 Rams. A very low scoring game indeed. Quarterback completion of passes drop significantly as wind speeds increase, touchdowns drop, and interceptions increase. Also, with increasing wind speeds, from thespax.com, the tipping point seems to be right after gusts reach about 14 miles per hour. And if they get over 30 miles per hour, our team is really in trouble. Scores also drop as wind speeds increase, according to safestbettingsites.com. Now turning to pressure and altitude, according to research from Penn State University, Denver football athletes actually have a competitive advantage over opponents not from there because their bodies are used to operating and performing with less oxygen. Teams will typically try to arrive early in order to acclimate to the mile-high city's higher altitude. It has been shown in a Scandinavian Journal of Medical Science and Sports article in 2008 that football performance decreases as altitude increases because of reduced oxygen availability. They also found that the football players can actually run faster at higher altitude, which is cool, but it also changes drag and impairs their sensory motor skills, think reaction times, so maybe not so cool. Footballs also travel faster and further in thinner high altitude air, which is about 82% as dense as the air at sea level. For example, field goals from visiting teams to Denver, Colorado, saw that their kickoffs travel about 8 yards farther on average than back home in their home field. How about that? This is mostly because the drag has changed due to less air molecules acting against the football. But the opposite can also happen in cold weather. The density of the air increases because it's cold and leads to less than stellar field goal accuracy and putt lengths, according to howstuffworks.com. Finally, we turn our attention to visibility. The quote, Fog Bowl was played in 1988 between the Bears and the Eagles during an NFC divisional playoff game at Chicago's Soldier Field. The fog reduced the visibility to 15 yards from the second quarter to the end of the game. This is an infamous game for poor performance by both teams. Some players even said they couldn't see the sidelines. Wow. That's pretty crazy. Again, the home field advantage ruled here with Chicago over the Eagles 20-12. This is one of the reasons for indoor sports stadiums for sure. So Major League Baseball has played through 3 out of 4 meteorological seasons, those being spring, summer, and fall. It is then not a mystery that weather can play a key role in baseball games and player performance. Starting with excessive heat, I found a study done with high school baseball players in hot and humid conditions during the summer months, completed in 1995, published in the National Library of Medicine. They found that baseball players actually lose almost 2% of their body weight due to perspiration alone. They also showed an increase in heart rate and oral temperature, leading the researchers to conclude that the weather conditions of extreme heat and humidity caused more stress on their bodies than the exercise itself. What? According to theweathernetwork.com, the hottest Major League Baseball game was played on August 26, 1988. in Arlington, Texas, where the Toronto Blue Jays played the Texas Rangers. At opening pitch around 8 p.m., the temperature was a blistering 109 degrees Fahrenheit. A 2013 study published in Weather, Climate, and Society found that, quote, runs scored, batting average, slugging percentage, on-base percentage, and home runs significantly increase, while walks significantly decrease in warm weather compared to cold weather. So, speaking of cold, baseball lore states that the offense has the advantage in warmer weather, but the defense, aka the pitcher, has the advantage in cold weather. The cold air actually affects how far the baseball will travel through the air. As stated in the AccuWeather article I read, a fly ball in April could be a home run in August. That's a pretty impressive influence by just the weather. The difference being that in April, the temperature might be 40 degrees, and in August, more like 90 degrees. We'll be covering more on this later, but baseballs can actually travel farther at higher altitudes, so much so that the Colorado Rockies team began storing their baseballs in a humidor in order to adjust the, quote, bounciness of the baseball, because they were quite literally and consistently hitting the baseballs out of the park. What a problem to have, right? This is because the air at higher altitudes is less dense or thinner. Again, more on this later. This thinner air can also affect types of pitches like curveballs and sliders, known as breaking balls. They typically will not break as much in the thinner air conditions, so pitchers need to know this in order to adjust to these colder air situations. Just like in the football games above, baseball players also have trouble keeping their grips in colder weather, and not surprisingly also in hot weather because of sweaty hands. But batters seem to have the advantage in warmer weather conditions, whereas the pitcher has the advantage in cold weather, just like the adage says. Actually, the coldest World Series on record was played in 38 degrees with a wind chill that felt more like 18 degrees back in 1997. There were ice patches on the game field and light snow flurries fell throughout the game, according to the blog on WUSA9. That doesn't sound like a very pleasant game day to me. Also, cold weather means the sting of the baseball striking the bat is perceived to be greater. The coldest MLB game played on record was April 2013 at 23 degrees, the Braves were playing at the Rockies, which had already postponed the game three times. There was a call put out to gather volunteers to shovel the snow out of the field, and I'm guessing the stands as well. It was suggested by Sports.com that this was the shortest game ever played at Coors Field as well. I can see why. Now, when it comes to precipitation in baseball, the humidity alone can affect the baseball. Even though humid air is less dense, the baseball will actually travel further in dry air compared to humid air because the humid air causes the baseball to become heavier. Did you know that only 8 Major League Baseball stadiums have roofs, and all but one of those are retractable? Which leaves 22 stadiums out in the rain. Get it? Out in the rain. Okay, by the way, it doesn't have to be rain. Something as little as cloud cover can impair the outfielder from sealing the ball off the bat. But according to AccuWeather.com, the reverse situation of bright, sunny blue skies can also affect how baseball players judge fly balls due to their depth perception. This is especially an issue in open-air ballparks that face the south or the west, and California is the main offender of this with the worst sun glare conditions. Of course! Delays of game are quite common, whether it be a passing shower or a torrential downpour. Camden Yards in Baltimore, Maryland has a rain room where staff monitor live weather data and provide it to the umpire when necessary. If a clear the field call is made, a team of people jump into action with a 28,900 square foot tarp, basically it's big, to cover home plate, the pitcher's mound, and base paths. This stadium and other stadiums that are newer and like it also have drainage systems that has the potential to remove, get this, 16 inches of water per hour through what's called a sand root zone. The tarp can be directly unloaded and dumped out into the outfield. Pretty cool, right? Baseball is played in a mostly open area and is thus highly subject to the whims of the wind. In fact, very high wind gusts can knock the pitcher off the mound, which, according to Earth Network's blog, happened in a 2017 AAA game between the Salt Lake Bees and the Omaha Storm Chasers. That's crazy! Now, when it comes to each stadium, they each have their own unique wind conditions based on surroundings. Is it in the city? Is it outside? Is it near a lake? Etc., etc. That's what we call in meteorology a microclimate. Now, sometimes windscreens are built to block the flow of the wind around the stadium, but this is definitely a major influence on the outcome of the baseball game. It can either help the offense or the defense, depending on its direction and its magnitude. As we turn to pressure and altitude, we consider Coors Field in Denver, Colorado. It's also referred to as Hitter's Field, since the less air drag because of less air molecules being a mile high, the baseballs can seem to hit there easier and they travel further. Actually, Major League Baseball has a hitter-friendly and pitcher-friendly statistic, and Coors Field has made top five for several years, which seems to confirm that the thinner air makes it easier to make a hit. And finally, we talk about visibility. Visibility and fog is definitely an issue for baseball games. I mean, how can you pitch a baseball to the hitter if you can't see them? Or on the other end of things, what if you're the hitter and you can't see the baseball flying towards your face? That's bad. In 2007, thefarleygroup.com reports that Minor League Baseball's Eastern League All-State game was being played in Dodd Stadium in Norwich, Connecticut, which experienced some poor visibility conditions due to fog. The outfielders kept missing the catches. Finally, the umpire and the team managers called the game early, just in case. Now switching over to soccer, let's start with excessive heat. Major League Soccer has policies in place that take into account the wet bulb globe temperature. I know you're going to hear it again and again in this podcast, so by now you know it takes into account the temperature, humidity, wind speed, sun angle, and cloud cover, or the solar radiation. This is becoming a worldwide standard in sports. If the BGT reaches 82 Fahrenheit, then mandatory hydration breaks go into effect at the 30-minute and 75-minute mark of the match. Games can actually be delayed if it reaches over 92.3 Fahrenheit, and the LA Times suggested that delays can get a little bit complicated and controversial when major sports TV networks are involved. Shouldn't the safety of the players be the top priority? Well, that's what they suggested. Now, it's important in these types of extreme heat conditions to check on the goalie often. Most soccer or similarly field hockey players don't wear much sports equipment. Meanwhile, the poor goalie is there melting underneath all of that protective gear. Teams should limit outdoor practices to less than 3 hours, preferably after the peak sunlight hours of 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Intensity of workouts should slowly increase, and hydration should be practiced like your life depends on it. Electrolytes are easily lost during these hardcore sweat sessions. Drink water with electrolytes like sodium, potassium, and chloride. Also watch for symptoms of heat exhaustion and stroke, feeling faint or dizzy, excessive sweating, nausea, or vomiting. Rapid, weak pulse and muscle cramps are all symptoms of heat exhaustion. This can be treated by getting to a cold place with air conditioning, drinking fluids, and applying cold compresses. Heat stroke, however, is when you stop sweating. That's really bad. May have a throbbing headache, a higher body temperature, a strong, rapid pulse, and you can actually lose consciousness. So this requires immediate medical attention. Call 911. Don't even play around. Did you know that during the last FIFA World Cup in Brazil, they actually made drink breaks mandatory because temperatures were over 104 degrees Fahrenheit? And in the freezing cold, just like football, soccer players are also more prone to injuries. Warming up properly becomes super important. WWeek.com reports that the coldest match in Major League Soccer history was the Colorado Rapids playing the Portland Timbers back in March 2019, where there were, quote, piles of snow everywhere, and the temperature a mere 18 degrees. Nope. As far as precipitation goes, soccer games will generally continue even during rainstorms unless the visibility becomes so poor that officials deem it unsafe. One soccer match was delayed over 3 hours to allow the rainfall to cease in a Major League Soccer game, according to SoccerBlade.com. Only extreme rainfall conditions will cause a match to be canceled. One time in Italy, September 2016, there was such a dramatic heavy downpour that the pitch turned into a lake and the tunnel area at the stadium completely flooded, looking more like a river. That's according to 90minutes.com. And don't forget lightning from those storms. Play was put on hold for more than 30 minutes during the 2014 World Cup in Miami, where England was playing Honduras due to a nasty electrical storm. Reportedly, an entire soccer team in the Democratic Republic of Congo died in 1998 when lightning struck the pitch, so lightning is no joke in stadiums or open fields. Soccer fields after a good rain can produce a minefield of troubles for our soccer players, including puddles, muddy areas, and sinkholes, especially on natural grass surfaces. But artificial turf isn't much better. In fact, players have complained that the soccer ball moves faster on wet turf. It's harder to run on wet fields, it's easier to slip, and immense pressure ends up being put on the poor goalie, even though their boxes become a mud pit as well. This leads to some dramatic changes in scoring. Snow also causes headache. A blizzard in 2013 in Colorado kept on delaying the World Cup qualifier game between the United States team and Costa Rica. Only one goal was scored during the first 20 minutes of game due to poor visibility. Heavy snow has also canceled games in the past. If the soccer match isn't being played inside a dome and temperatures are on the chilly side, then wind chill needs to be considered. This is a measure of the temperature minus the chilling effect of the wind and how fast frostbite and hypothermia can occur. For example, it only takes 30 minutes to get frostbite if the wind chill drops below 19 Fahrenheit. Wearing layers is important and using thermals, plus protective gear for extremities like gloves and earmuffs. Other influences by the wind can be positive or negative depending on the direction and speed, but mainly on the direction. Having an advantage due to the wind can lead some teams to adjust their plays and help them get a quick lead over their competition, according to DiscoverSoccer.com. When it comes to pressure and altitude, an interesting study done in Australia, published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine in 2013, studied the effects of high altitude on soccer matches. They concluded that, quote, high altitude reduces the distance covered by elite youth soccer players during matches. Neither 13 days of acclimatization nor lifetime residence at high altitude protects against the detrimental effects of altitude on match activity profile. I think I just saw altitude acclimation training go out the window. Although this example seems to suggest otherwise, Bolivia played against Argentina in a soccer match back in 2009. The Bolivians had a clear advantage because their home stadium is in the Andes Mountains at nearly 12,000 feet above sea level. They crushed the Argentinians and dealt them their worst defeat in 60 years because they couldn't keep up in the thin air. And finally, fog also negatively impacts soccer matches. A pro game being played in Dijon, France in December 2016 was victim of heavy fog. It was so heavy that even though the soccer ball was headed right towards the goalie didn't react because he couldn't see the ball coming in the dense fog. Now that's crazy. Now we move to other sports worth mentioning, starting with tennis and excessive heat. Just like baseball, a 2014 study in the British Journal of Sports Medicine found that heat can take its toll on tennis players, especially in back-to-back matches on the same day. It challenges their bodies, their minds, and perception of effort, plus performance, as well as their physical well-being. In fact, in 2018, a new heat rule was implemented at the US Open in New York because of extreme temperatures that week. The new heat policy allowed for the male players to take a 10-minute break between the third and fourth sets. The Women's Tennis Association already had an excessive heat policy on the books. Hydration is also a must, of course, as electrolytes diminish very rapidly in such weather conditions. The warmest Wimbledon tournament on record was at 77 Fahrenheit in 1976, but the hottest day during a Wimbledon tournament was in 2015, July, when the thermometer reached 95 Fahrenheit. In January 2014, at the Australian Open in Melbourne, play was suspended on all uncovered courts due to a blistering temperature over 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Yikes. If you're going to play tennis in the cold, make sure you warm up properly to give your muscles a chance to know what's going on. Stay hydrated, just like the previous sports. Lung burn is real in the cold. Wear sunglasses to protect yourself against sun glare and wear gloves. Now here's some interesting facts. Firstly, racket strings stiffen in colder temperatures and are prone to breakage, so try using a softer string composition in cold weather. Secondly, tennis balls are also not fans of cold weather. The rubber that they're made of hardens, making them feel softer in hand, but really harder upon impact and less bouncy. You might find you need to adjust your game by aiming deeper and hitting a ball a bit harder to get over the net in cold weather. Did you know that the coldest Wimbledon was played in 1999 at 41 Fahrenheit? When it comes to precipitation, rain delays or cancellations are definitely a part of tennis. Although you can probably still play on a light rain surface, if the court gets too wet, it quickly becomes unplayable because of risk of injury. Also, the tennis ball itself can tend to absorb moisture. Think about the slobbery dog playing with his tennis ball. Yeah, you get the picture. And if it isn't dried as quickly as possible, that tennis ball is now ruined. Laying tennis balls in the sun is the best way to dry them out. Did you know that tennis has three types of courts? The first type are grass courts, and they're about the same as playing in your backyard when there's a bit of dew on the grass. Slipping is a real risk, plus damage to the grass itself is possible after it rains. The second type of court is hard courts. They get pretty slippery when wet. Proper tennis shoes may allow you to play on the wet hard court, but a couple of puddles can easily ruin your game anyways. Finally, there are clay courts, which actually do need watering from time to time, otherwise it will dry out and your tennis ball bounce might get a little chaotic. These are the only surfaces that can be played on in a steady rain, but not a torrential downpour. The wettest Wimbledon on record was 1997, receiving more than 4.5 inches of rain during the tournament, but the most famous year for precipitation was a storm that hit 1985, where an inch of rain fell in less than 25 minutes. Wow. And you might remember the famous rain cancellation of 1996, where Cliff Richard sang to the crowd at Wimbledon. This was before the retractable roof was installed to prevent such situations in 2009. When the roof is closed, fresh air is pumped in at nearly, this is crazy, 18 pounds per second to manage the environment, which is like really impressive engineering. And these were from bramwellbrown.com, who estimated that 7,500 umbrellas will be needed to cover the same area as the retractable roof. Okay, so don't forget about frostbite, which is definitely a key element in this outdoor game as well. Also, wind has a major influence on how hard the shots are that you take and how much power is required to make them. Especially playing into the wind, coming towards you that is, being focused on shot speed against the wind can lead to inaccuracies in aim, and vice versa, playing with the wind at your back helps you make the shot more easily. The wind is definitely the most difficult weather element for this sport. And when it comes to pressure and altitude, just like the other sports that we've covered, tennis is influenced by altitude. The ball will generally bounce higher at higher altitudes due to the lower pressure, and you don't need as much power to make shots. However, it might take a while to adapt to the new environment since the tennis ball can travel further with less air drag and faster. And of course, you might find yourself running out of breath sooner because of the lower amounts of oxygen that we talked about earlier. Also note that as the temperature warms, the air inside the tennis ball will expand and make them bounce higher, according to healthlivingazcentral.com. And now we transition to golf and start with excessive heat. Now let's not be selfish. Humans aren't the only one feeling the heat. Let's talk about the greens that we're playing on. That's right, the grass feels the heat too. There are entire maintenance staff employed just to keep the grass happy. Turfgrass engineering is a degree, so now it's down to a science. Although most of these ball games require grass or turf to play on, I'm going to focus on golfing greens right now. Sometimes you might see maintenance staff using water or sprinklers to cool different areas. Of course, grass needs water, but it also helps the green to suffer a little bit less under extreme heat. Fans are also sometimes placed to cool the green during hot weather and or dry the green. After all, soggy green is no good, which is one of the reasons why venting aeration is a common practice as well, which creates small holes in the putting surface to get water and air moving down below. That means healthy, oxygenated soil and roots, so no puddles. Now, for the record, the hottest percentage days where temperatures exceed 90 degrees in a PGA Tour is at FedEx St. Jude's Classic in Memphis, Tennessee. Surprising, right? Don't underestimate the heat in the South. And cold can cause players to add an additional handicap. It causes muscle stiffness like we talked about before and therefore makes it harder to achieve the same shots without increasing effort. In addition to that, the colder air is more dense and creates additional drag on the ball. Finally, bulkier winter weather gear can actually affect stroke speeds, and this is from Golf Digest. According to the PGA research, the coldest play in PGA Tours is the WGC Accenture match play in Marana, Arizona at the Dove Mountain Resort, where the temperature drops to around 41 degrees on average. In fact, it holds the most extreme conditions of play, where in 2013 it was almost canceled due to heavy snow conditions. Speaking of snow, let's talk about precipitation. Golf can 100% be called off for rain. It affects everything from the green, to the player's grip, to the shot distance. It can cause players to slip on the green, and it can cause something called a plug ball, where the golf ball is stuck in the mud instead of rolling onto the fairway green. It can also make it harder to control the trajectory, since the tiny dimples on the ball can actually fill with water, and the club can't make clean contact with it, as it would in dry weather, according to golfingfocus.com. They also say that rain makes it harder to concentrate. That's arguable, I think. Proper equipment like golfing balls, club grips, soft spiked waterproof golf shoes, hats, an umbrella, waterproof jackets, and trousers, and tons of towels can go a long way to make your golfing in the rain much more bearable. You may also need to adjust your play in the rain, but you should never, ever play in a thunderstorm. And hiding under a tree during an electrical storm might be just the last thing that you do. Take proper shelter inside a building. The Rainiest Golf Course Award goes to the Zurich Classic in Louisiana, New Orleans, which gets the most rainfall on a given day, and during a four-day tournament, and has the high risk of lightning strikes. Yikes! Speaking of lightning strikes, the AT&T National at Pebble Beach, California, and John Deere Classic at Silvis, Illinois, have strike densities of more than 2 per hour, which is nothing compared to events in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Even more fun, the John Deere Classic holds the highest wind speed gust record at 65.6 miles per hour. Try golfing in that. The Old White TPC in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, and the Puerto Rico Open also hold records for wet weather in PGA events from BleacherReport.com. Golf is another sport where wind is very important. Wind affects both the speed of the shot, increasing or decreasing drag, and more dramatically, the direction or travel of the ball. There's a rule of thumb in golf that you should have 1% distance for every 1 mile per hour of headwind, and when playing downwind, it reverses to a 0.5% less distance, according to golfglam.co.uk. Crosswinds can also become an annoyance to your golf game. That little golf ball can definitely be carried by the wind, and greater the wind speed, the greater the influence. So you would think that a place like Hawaii would be the ideal golfing location, right? Well, not so, apparently. The Hyundai Tournament of Champions is played in Kapula on the island of Maui, but according to PGA research, it's the most likely to be affected by heavy winds. In 2013, the winds caused a reduction of holes to 54, and even that was difficult. As far as pressure and altitude goes, again, this is probably old hat to you now, but the golf ball is also influenced by altitude. Thinner air will cause the drag forces on the ball to change, and it can also more easily move through the thinner air. This changes the distance due to reductions in drag, which can actually be calculated. I know, math. And it's actually a myth that the ball will spin faster at higher altitudes. Sorry, that's from Titleist.com. And pretty obvious, but fog impacts golf as well. You need to be able to see where to hit the golf ball. For example, the golf course in San Diego, where Farmers Insurance Open is held, can be subject to some fairly foggy conditions. In fact, in 2013, a thick blanket of fog made the course unplayable and pushed the event to the following day. Okay, now let's transition and talk about motorsports and excessive heat. In extreme heat, NASCAR's cars actually become quite unbearable. Exhaust combined with the limited undercar airflow increases cabin temperatures, and in addition to many safety features, they essentially seal the car, making it kind of like an oven. And on top of that, drivers are required to use more safety gear like multi-layer fire suits, gloves, helmets, etc., etc. All of these combine together to make a very uncomfortable ride. It's not like driving your sedan. So why don't they just use air conditioning, Professor? Well, that's a great question. NASCAR prohibits the use of any type of refrigerant or pressurized gas or liquids due to their possibility of escaping in an accident, which is terrible for the environment. Also, it takes enormous amounts of energy to use an air conditioner. The only thing NASCAR's cars are built for is speed. So more energy for AC means less for the engine and slower car. Boo. Also, it would have to be bigger than the ones in commercial vehicles for the NASCAR driver to even feel a difference. And of course, we can't have that because that messes with the weight ratio of the race vehicle. Now, all that being said, NASCAR does require some functioning level of AC either in the helmet or the seat of the driver. Also, it's the driver and the team's responsibility to stay in shape and hydrated to be in good condition for their races, because they can actually lose 5 pounds of body weight in fluids alone. Also, I want to mention here that the temperature affects the grip level of the tires. This is why cars will perform differently in different locations, just based on weather conditions alone. How about that? But if it gets too hot, then the oils on the asphalt will start pooling, making it difficult for the tires to grip. So there's kind of like a middle ground there that's perfect. Generally speaking, the cold isn't a problem for this sport. As we just covered, temperatures inside the racing vehicle will stay warm, or should I say hot, well into November, the end of NASCAR season. But cold does affect their tires, just like it affects yours and mine, making them too hard and more difficult to drive around the track, from NASCAR.com. Precipitation? Well, NASCAR events will be postponed due to rain, because basically it becomes almost like an ice skating rink with the bald tires, which are special performance tires, oil on the road, and the high rates of speed. and also in part to the spray from the tires hitting moisture on the track, which then gets on the windshield and da da da, right? A quick shower usually leads to a race being put on hold, but a heavy and uninterrupted rain usually leads to the race being suspended for hours or possibly even moved to the following day. The longest rain delay, according to AccuWeather.com, was in 2014. The Daytona 500 had a rain delay that was 6 hours and 22 minutes long. And even more exciting, a tornado warning was issued, leading to an evacuation of the crowd in the stadium. Motorsports have specially made air tightens to dry their tracks before restarting a race. The longer the track, the longer it takes to dry, as you would expect. Rain delays can also lead to using different strategies to win the race, although these don't always work out. Now, wind from the right direction can definitely aid the driver in his competitive driving. It can also determine balance and when to enter a corner. Corners are important for loading and grip purposes, according to NBCSports.com. Now, let's talk about drafting really quick here. Drafting isn't so much about wind as most people might think. It's really the temporary, almost vacuum left by the car ahead that a car behind then takes advantage of. Think of it like the car ahead is plowing through the air, creating a path that the car behind can follow. Multiple cars can sometimes take advantage of this aerodynamic phenomenon. And although the drafting cars can get greater speeds at better fuel efficiency, it also has the potential for disaster, as the cars have to be relatively close together to take advantage of drafting. Now, not surprisingly, motorsports' performance has a strong dependence upon air density. That's the nature of combustion engines. It needs oxygen to burn fuel. Performance vehicles tuning up must rely on uncorrected barometric pressure readings. What's that mean, you ask? Well, in meteorology, to compare stations at different altitudes, like Denver to Washington, D.C., we've developed a standardized barometric pressure reading that uses a formula to correct for the earth or the rock beneath the higher altitude station. Where that's useful for meteorologists, that is not helpful when tuning a performance vehicle. The fuel system must always be adjusted for the altitude and barometric value. Vehicles must also be adjusted for humidity, since higher humidity conditions are less dense air, leading to less oxygen available for our sports car. By the way, high humidity at a race can also lead to chunks of rubber breaking loose from the track surface, and usually a spray-on treatment is used to counter the effects of humidity, but it becomes pretty much useless at very humid conditions. Coastal tracks also need power considerations because of their higher humidity and sea level elevation, according to RacingJunk.com. And just like on the interstate, mist and fog can delay or postpone motorsport games. And now we turn our attention to volleyball. Now, when it comes to excessive heat, volleyball is no slouch either. Playing on hot sand is definitely a different situation than nice, cool grass. Volleyball in Australia has a heat policy set in place by the Sports Medicine in Australia. Their policy takes into account, guess what? The wet bulb globe temperature, which takes into account the high temperature and humidity, etc. The higher the risk of thermal injury, as they call it, the more likely you should consider postponing and or canceling the volleyball event. The British Journal of Sports Medicine in 2012 stated that new guidelines need to be implemented to manage heat stress in elite sports, and especially volleyball. Did you know that snow volleyball was a thing? Yup. Volleyball players from several countries, including South Korea, Austria, China, Brazil, and Serbia, are petitioning for snow volleyball to be included in Winter Olympics. So far, not yet. But the International Volleyball Federation and the European Volleyball Confederation, or CEV, last held their snow volleyball event on Valentine's Day 2018 during the South Korea's Winter Olympic Games, which is from Mashable.com. And precipitation also affects volleyball, but probably not in the way you think. During the Beijing 2008 Summer Olympics, heavy rain almost converted volleyball into water polo. Although some fans decided to stay home, players were unfazed by the lashing by the elements, according to Reuters.com. And you're likely tired of hearing it by now, but wind also plays a key role in volleyball as well. Passing sometimes needs to be adjusted, and also playing tactics to avoid losing the ball to the high winds. And like our other sports we covered, altitude can affect volleyball athletes as well. Fun fact, the highest and biggest beach volleyball tournament in Europe is the Gstaad Major, played in the Alps at 3,445 feet above sea level. Now, I couldn't find any information on fog's influence on volleyball, but I can't imagine it would make playing any easier. Now we turn to some leftover tidbits of information that I dug up. Starting with track and excessive heat, the track trials for the U.S. Olympic Games that were delayed due to COVID were held back in June this year, 2021. They were being held in Eugene, Oregon, which was unfortunately experiencing a record-breaking heat wave at the time. The trials had to be delayed from 3:30 Pacific time to 8:30 p.m. when temperatures finally died down. When it comes to track or cross country, staying hydrated is still important in the cold as well as warm, as well as properly warming up and stretching to protect muscles in cold weather. Track is still practiced if there is rain, but not if there is lightning. And we probably all experience this on a blustery day, but headwinds will slow you down. So in running sports like track or just running in general, for exercise, a headwind is going to work against your pace, where a tailwind might just help you out. Likely the same influence as before apply here as it comes to pressure and altitude. Less oxygen makes it harder for sea level athletes to perform compared to higher altitude athletes, which use less oxygen because of their hometown advantage. And when it came to visibility, I couldn't find anything on fog related to outdoor track. And next up we have cycling. Here I focus on the Tour de France and how the weather influences the cyclists in their grueling journey. Let's talk about excessive heat. Perhaps the most famous cycling event is the Tour de France, where cyclists will arduously check on a bicycle through the French countryside as well as neighboring countries and through multiple mountain ranges. You may not be aware, but actually performance has been directly linked to how the cyclist copes with the heat. Riding up and down mountains is treacherous and challenging enough on its own, let alone on a hot and humid day. You may have noticed that the cyclists wear bright clothes to reflect radiation and sprinkle water on their heads intermittently. Dehydration must also be avoided at all costs. The hottest Tour de France was back in 2010 when it was 145.4 degrees at road level, according to VeloNews.com. Colder temperatures as the cyclists reach higher elevations can put the cyclists at risk of hypothermia and frostbite. Reaction times also slow down, meaning crashes might be more likely since frozen hands can't change gears as quickly, from SBUNation.com. Rain makes roads for the cyclists traveling even more treacherous. While traveling at 40 miles per hour, the last thing you want to do is hit a puddle and lose control. Heavy snow actually caused a reduction in mileage back in the 1996 Tour de France, so adverse weather conditions can definitely play a key role in this sport. The group of riders will try and travel in a diagonal line to shield the rider who has the best time from the wind, according to AccuWeather.com, but crosswinds can break up this pattern and make even cycling in a straight line difficult. It can also be dangerous and make cyclists prone to falls. Using winds to get leads on competitors is a common tactic in the Tour de France. And I'm not going to bore you at this point repeating the above-mentioned altitude effects. Just know that they're present here as well. Finally, visibility changes in elevation along these different mountain ranges and also proximity to the ocean can sometimes lead to foggy conditions along their route. This can make very dangerous situations. Like back in 1998, the Tour de France, where 30 riders fell during stage 10 during the descent of the high mountains of the Pyrenees. And finally, before our quiz, let's not forget the spectators, or as we say in the States, the fans. So an excessive heat, dehydration, and heat illness is definitely a concern for fans as well. For example, in May 2018, over 200 fans had to be treated for heat-related sickness as temperatures soared past 90 degrees at the Indy 500 in Indianapolis, Indiana. We might not be the performing ones doing the feats ourselves, but being outside in the heat and humidity with your favorite sports team can still affect you. Water is your best source of hydration, and although it's a popular sports spectator beverage choice, alcohol is the worst choice that you can make on a hot day because it has diuretic properties, leading to more dehydration, but also the lack of good judgment that sometimes accompanies alcohol consumption. Also, staying in the shade, wearing loose-fitting clothing, and wearing sunscreen are all important preventive measures. Now, CBS News reported back in 2018 that the Winter Olympics cold temperatures caught many spectators off guard. It was so cold that even the ATM stopped working. That's cold. Several people were diagnosed with hypothermia conditions. If you're headed to a game in the cold, bundle up, dress in layers, wear a hat, gloves, basically cover up as much as you possibly can. Hand and foot warmers can go a long way, but if you're an avid sports fan in love with sports that play in such conditions, maybe it's time to invest, and I mean invest, in a heated jacket. Just remember to charge it before you go to the game. And obviously the above sports must also take into account the safety of their fans when it comes to precipitation. Rain might cancel some games, but others don't mind at all. So you should pack your umbrella, parka, or a plastic garbage bag. Hey, don't judge. There are even single seating, rainproof viewing booths that you can buy. I gotta get me one of those. Bad weather struck again at the 2018 Winter Olympics, where spectators inside Olympic Park were told to seek shelter due to a particularly nasty windstorm, just in case the temporary structures were damaged. In general, wind is just annoying to fans and can lead to loss of objects like scarves, but one must be prepared for wind chill conditions and windy and cold weather. As stated above, layers and covering the most body surface areas possible is your best bet, but if it's that kind of cold, this fan is staying home and watching it on TV. Don't think that only athletes are affected by altitude. Spectators are too. Remember my hiking story from earlier. And finally, and I think this is obvious, but poor visibility, whether from sun glare, heavy precipitation like a downpour or blizzard, or fog, is irritating to fans looking to watch every exciting moment of their team's game. Haha, now it is quiz time. All right, question one. Football, baseball, tennis, and golf are most impacted by which weather element? Is it hot and cold temperatures? Precipitation? Wind? Pressure and altitude? Or visibility? That's right, it's wind. Alright, question two. Which type of sport will not cancel due to rain? Is it American football, baseball, soccer, tennis, golf, motorsports, or volleyball? Actually, it's a combination. It would be American football, soccer, and volleyball that do not cancel due to rain. Unless in extreme conditions. Question three, motorsports are most impacted by which weather element? Is it hot and cold temperatures, precipitation, wind, pressure altitude, or visibility. That's right, it's precipitation. Slidey tires are bad. Okay, in which conditions, question four, should athletes focus on hydration more? Is it hot weather, cold weather, both, or neither? Yeah, I hope this one was an obvious trick question, but the answer is both, right? Although cold weather has low humidity, so you should definitely be hydrating. Hot weather, also you're sweating, so you should be hydrating. So the answer is both. All right, question five. I didn't cover this one specifically above, so it is a bonus. Which sport holds the record for highest number of lightning strike deaths? This data is from weather.gov. Is it soccer, golf, running/track, baseball, or football? All right, the answer is soccer, with 34% of all lightning strike deaths due to sports. The next is golf, 29%, running is 23%, baseball is 9%, and football is 3%. So how did you do on the quiz? All right, so I guess the bottom line is because sports are played by humans and human bodies are affected by their surrounding environmental conditions, sports are affected by weather. This will be important to realize and remember when we start, I don't know, robot sports leagues, think like Real Steel the movie, or interplanetary sports leagues in the future. Anyway, I hope you learned something new. Hope to see you next time.